The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok, and we're with Sochi Neveka. She is the state director of the Working Families Party. Welcome, Sochi.
Hello, Alan. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we very much wanted to have you. It's something I've been concerned about for quite a while. I speak with the governor a good deal, and I want to make sure I have this right. I haven't been shy about my feelings about this. So before we go into all of that, tell us about you. Because I always like to get a feeling about who we're talking to, where they were raised, who their parents were, and like that. What do you got?
Wonderful. So I'm Sochi Neveka. I am a born and bred New Yorker. I am the daughter of Nigerian immigrants who live in Westchester County and have, you know, spent a lot of time understanding and coming to terms with the identity of being a first generation, you know, American to African immigrant parents, and spent a lot of time wrestling with what does it mean to live and love a country that your parents don't call their own. And so politics and organizing was a way that I was able to square the contradictions of my identity, to be able to build solidarity, build relationships across difference, recognize that even if my upbringing or my parents' origin story differed from that of my neighbors or my classmates, there was a shared vision or shared desire to create a neighborhood, a school, a state, a country that made space for all of us to live lives of full potential. My parents invested a lot in education, being the way that me and my siblings made good lives for ourselves in this country. And so I was able to go to university, and I went to Yale College, where the thing that I learned the most was actually that solidarity-based struggle. I got very involved in the labor movement with the union that represented clerical and cafeteria workers on campus, and got pulled into a really beautiful cross-class, cross-racial movement struggle to make New Haven and to make the state a better place for all people, and to have Yale as the number one employer in the region really be accountable both to the workers, to the neighborhood that it existed in, and have the students be an active, play an active role in creating shared opportunity, shared prosperity across. So I've been in organizing now for many years, done labor organizing, did political organizing, did community organizing most recently at the Center for Popular Democracy. And I come to the WFP in a moment where I think that progressives have, you know, a lot of wind under her sails, and we're excited to fight for real transformational politics. And I think that the party represents such a strong vehicle for a lot of the aspirations of working people.
So what's happened to the Working Families Party, as you say, WFP? What's become of it? You know, we used to have something in New York State, I'm so old, called the Liberal Party, and it sort of disgraced itself and went out of business. And the Working Families Party has become, you know, the sort of conscience or left of the regular Democratic Party. Is that a fair assessment?
I think what the role we see ourselves playing is that we are both strategic actors. We know how to win, run elections, and recruit really strong candidates into public office. And we see ourselves as a political home for people who maybe feel locked out of the political system, who feel as though the major parties don't fully represent their values, who feel as though, you know, the two-party system that forces you often to make calculations based on a lesser of two evils does not feel like it's feeding a robust democracy. And so we seek to create a movement home by really providing moral leadership and pushing on issues that we know working people, marginalized people, low-income communities need and require for the state to work for them and to put our electoral savvy and our strategy behind that. And so, you know, in the last couple of years, obviously, we played an important role in removing the IDC and really replacing them with true progressive.
Let's stop there. The one thing we don't like to do around here is give initials, because the Independent Democratic Conference, which you've just said, was made up of Democrats who kept the Republicans in power in New York State. And you did do a hell of a job there. You want to tell us about that?
Yes. I mean, it was a real power grab. It was an opportunity for Democrats in name only to caucus with the Republicans as a way to undermine real legislative change. And obviously it worked in the governor's interest because he ultimately got to set the agenda. There was no real majority, and there was always a battle. And so many progressive priorities were stymied, were never given real life. And so what happens then when we had a strong coalition of working party, labor, community groups, et cetera, recruit, run, and then elect new champions in the state Senate to take over that conference, what you saw was a flood of legislative change, rent reforms, criminal justice reform, immigrant rights work, a climate bill. So real historic change became possible. The squashing of the IDC, the Independent Democratic Conference, that was when we actually saw a true Democratic majority. We no longer just had Democrats in name only. We're able to lead and push on an agenda that came from working people. And 2019 was a transformative year across the state.
So into all of this comes a hell of a fight. And my friend, the governor, has seemed to have a real problem with the Working Families Party because, in a way, he and his colleagues in both the Senate and the Assembly, the leadership, are making it almost impossible for you guys to get a place on the ballot because of the required number of voters you need to get in the last election. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah. Folks may or may not know, right, about this time last year, the legislature and the governor gave birth to a commission, ostensibly or first to consider public financing, and then in the dead of night added a requirement to look into the very nature of fusion voting. Fusion voting is what gives minor parties the ability to get voters to vote their values without spoiling on races, right? So it's a really clear democratic, democracy, pro-democracy tool. The commission passed recommendations in December that massively jacked up the requirements for ballot access, right? So the number of votes we need to get to even be a party went from 50,000 every 4 years to 130,000 or 2%, whichever is higher, every 2 years. And so the burden of even being a party became quite large. We took it to court because we felt that the law was on our side, and this was an unconstitutional delegation, among other things. And the court ruled in our favor a few weeks ago. And last week, during the budget then, this was pushed through, right? The commission recommendations that were just invalidated by the courts was pushed through. So we're reverting this back to this high 130,000 votes every 2 years. In a bill, a transportation economic development bill, you know, buried in there. And so it felt really like in this moment of pandemic, when we're looking for the budget to meet the needs of the most vulnerable New Yorkers, party politics were still, you know, considered a top priority. This had no space, no place in this budget. The legislature never pushed for it. New Yorkers have consistently demonstrated that they wanted more choice, not less choice, when it comes to their democratic participation. So we feel like it was a really cynical move to do so under the cover of a pandemic, with only, you know, one person who had, or, you know, a small group of people who had any real interest in this being an outcome.
So what was the reason, do you think? I mean, I hate to get into motives, but obviously, obviously there was a motive that the governor and the legislative leaders wanted to increase it. Now, if I asked them, they'd say, oh, well, that's the right way to do it, because otherwise it was too easy to get on the ballot. But there must be a reason for coming so assiduously against the Working Families Party.
I mean, you're saying I do not want to get into the game of assuming motive, but I think what is clear, what it seems rational, is that we have been checking executive power, right? We have been pushing as a progressive movement to make sure that our agenda is what gets signed by the governor, and that rather that he is not controlling all aspects of New York State politics. We believe in a strong, robust democracy and having all three branches of government play a real role in shaping shaping the world that we live in. And so we were quite successful at that last year. And it seems as though as the progressive movement gets stronger, the attack against us also gets stronger. So for us, we feel like, you know, this makes New York State honestly one of the most hostile places for third parties. It is both the number of votes on the line and the frequency at which ballot qualification is required. And so if not for a direct reason to make it very hard for minor parties to exist, even though we know that we play a huge role in making people more able to vote and participate and more able to communicate their needs and their desires in the democratic process, Democrats across the country, Stacey Abrams, great, you know, strong leaders, are pushing for more options. We saw what happened in Wisconsin. We need to be moving away from it being more difficult for people, especially the most vulnerable and impacted people, to participate in our process. We think this moves us backwards in terms of progress when it comes to democracy and voter choice.
So let me ask you this. How have you done in the last couple of elections?
We feel strongly that as a party of organizers, if this is the threshold, we will build to get the threshold, right? So over 100,000 people regularly vote, you know, on the Working Families Party line. We usually do so in gubernatorial years. This is a new experiment to do it in a presidential year, especially one with very high turnout. But nonetheless, it is quite a precipitous leap to be going from 50,000 to, you know, 2% of Democratic turnout.
Can you do it?
We plan to. We plan to. And you feel like especially in this year where, you know, the crisis has really opened up for people how government is or is not actually responding to what people need, right? The austerity budget that was put out by the state legislature and by the governor in this moment is not reflective of what the front lines need. And so we're building a party of the front lines. We are clear that we hold those interests. And so we need to make sure that people understand that voting on the WFP line in November is a vote against austerity, is a vote for the New York for the many that people really deserve. And so it's our job as organizers to make sure people really understand that and see the ballot line as an opportunity to demonstrate that to leadership.
Well, yes, but the governor says he doesn't have the money. I think he's right. You know, he said he was a $6 billion in the hole and he had to pull back and he has to say, if you don't have the money, you can't spend it. He's right about that, isn't he?
The state does not have the money in its coffers. New York State has its money, the money in its people and large institutions, right? We are home to 112 billionaires. We are home to some of the largest well-funded corporations. And we think it is adamant, it is necessary for any moral leader to look at increasing revenue in this moment, right? We are making cuts on social services. We are making cuts to education. We are making cuts to hospitals in this moment of pandemic. And so we're making choices. There's a choice to increase the revenue of those who are able to shoulder a little bit more risk, a little bit more burden. That's what we call fair share. And so without actually exploring that, when we know that many people and corporations will come out ahead in this pandemic, we have to be creative and we have to be courageous in making sure that we are exploring all revenue outcomes before we start slashing the most critical social services that vulnerable and middle class and working and low income New Yorkers depend on.
Now we're talking to Xochitl Nemica, the state director of the Working Families Party in New York. Xochitl, if I may call you that, I know it's familiar, but let me ask you this. Isn't what you're espousing good old fashioned just soak the rich? You got them, soak them, and then the answer is if you soak them, they'll move to Florida like the president of the United States just did. What do you make of that?
I mean, we have seen, you know, there was an era not so long ago when there were higher taxes on corporations, when we had real taxes on various financial tools that did not push Wall Street away, that did not decrease the number of wealthy people who live here, actually increase the number of wealthy people who live here. And we're seeing that even, you know, creative forms of taxation are not pushing people out. We don't think about a soaking the rich analogy, but rather we think about where is the risk flowing, and the risk right now is flowing entirely downwards.
Right? Yeah, but you do, Xochitl, you do want to increase taxes in order to fund these programs, right?
We need to increase taxes. We think the tax burden is not high enough. We think that working people right now are absorbing most of the risk, and those are the people who are leaving New York State. And so we're choosing. Do we want more people to head to the Poconos and the South, et cetera, because they can't actually survive in New York State, a state of great diversity, a state of where cross-class living is a hallmark, you know, of our state. And we're making choices in this moment about who we think New York is for. And right now we're making a choice that New York is for the wealthy. And that will have major reverberations and major effects that will affect generations to come. We think that there's a moment right now to right-size that, that will not harm the wealthiest corporations and the wealthiest people in our state, but will actually make New York a state where shared prosperity and where many people can thrive and not just the wealthy few.
So let's go to the state Senate. You finally, after all of these years, there's no Republican state Senate. All kinds of progressive things, you've mentioned some of them, have happened as a result of it. But the people in the Senate come from marginal districts, which were basically drawn to help the Republicans, but they just ran out of bodies. So the question is, don't you risk losing the Senate by being ultra progressive?
What we focus on, we think the focus of the party is to make sure we're supporting the platform and supporting candidates who are really trying to push, you know, our state in the most progressive direction. And so that is where our partnership with the Senate leadership and with the, you know, when we're thinking about a Senate majority, that is where our partnership lies. And it's incredibly important to do so. Right now, we have the opportunity to pick up seats, right, where Republicans have retired or, you know, have left. We're doing a lot of great work in the Hudson Valley and in Rochester, places that, you know, are maybe not pushing in the same direction as New York City, but have a strong working class base who wants a lot of the same programs and investments that the party is pushing for. And so we think that there's a real opportunity to increase the progressive ranks, you know, by tapping into places in Rochester and Buffalo and the Hudson Valley. And so we don't necessarily subscribe to the myth of that, you know, progressivism only exists in the urban centers or, you know, in majority minority districts. We really do think that our message resonates, and we want to make sure that we're helping to increase the Senate majority with a really strong progressive tilt.
Well, we have some time. You guys, of course, supported Bernie Sanders and his now defunct campaign. Discuss the implications of his stepping out.
Well, we are, I mean, incredibly proud, honestly, of the campaign that Senator Sanders ran, that Senator Warren ran, that really pushed a strong message of structural reform. And so what we're seeing now, especially in this pandemic, is that a lot of the same messages they're talking about before COVID, canceling student debt, rental assistance, Medicare for all, are being picked at, you know, by the Democratic establishment, and we're taking kind of piecemeal, a patchwork assemblage of that policy, of that platform. We know that that's the only platform that will make it possible for us to get out of this pandemic and limit crisis, you know, avert crisis in the future. And so Bernie Sanders played a huge role in giving people the intellectual material and the policy material to start thinking about how to get out of crisis. And so we know that he really pushed the whole field in a strong direction. And we know that, you know, the presumptive Democratic nominee, that, you know, Joe Biden is even, you know, has incorporated some of that material into his agenda. And so we need to continue as a movement to make sure that there is life for those critical programs, student debt, Medicare for all, housing guarantee, et cetera, things that were thought of as pipe dreams that now we really see across America. They're pulling very highly. People see the necessity of interventions like this.
Okay, so we're talking to Xochitl Nemica, the state director of the Working Families Party in New York. Is there a danger under your leadership, Xochitl, that you might pull the party too far left and lose some of the people who have proudly voted for the party in the past because they didn't want to vote for the Democrats?
We are building a broad base, whether ideologically or morally, they feel pushed out by the Democrats. And we think that our policies, our vision, there's a lot of space up and down the state and across the state for it. So we really try to lean with our values. We think that we need a state that works for the many and the few. We think that working people should be able to thrive. We think students should deserve fully funded education. And so I think our vision of the type of New York that we want brings a broad coalition, including people who joined the party at a different moment, right, when the state overall was in a more rightward direction, and the party was playing a role in kind of moving things slowly in a more progressive direction. And so right now it's actually a beautiful coalition of folks who live upstate and their representatives have a slightly different agenda or orientation to things like taxation, and people who are, you know, in Brooklyn or the Rockaways, et cetera. And so we really want to hold on to all of our people. We know that we need a mass-based party that reaches, you know, people in all corners of the state. And so that's what I'm completely focused on. How do we lead with a moral agenda? How do we make sure people's voices are heard in a high participation party? And they feel as though these are political manifestations of their dreams and aspirations for themselves and their families.
Let's talk about COVID. Obviously, we're hearing now that minorities, people of color, are having higher incidences of infection than people who, you know, may have a little bit more money demographically and be in a better spot. What do you make of that?
I mean, obviously, it is devastating. You know, someone, I live very much in the epicenter. You know, my father is a healthcare worker in his 70s, and I'm fearful all the time. My younger brother has asthma. These are not coincidences, right? But we know that COVID is a social justice issue in many ways, that COVID maps onto environmental justice issues. People with higher rates of asthma or heart disease are more likely to fall vulnerable to the disease. And that maps onto wealth lines, that maps onto racial lines. And so this is why we need a two-pronged approach. We need immediate relief and make sure that healthcare workers and patients get the protections that they need and get the high level of care that they need. And on the other hand, we need to make sure that we're thinking about eradicating those gaps that make COVID map onto difference in the first place. We have to talk about health disparities. It is not a coincidence that the Bronx is the poorest congressional, you know, the poorest congressional district in the country and has astronomical rates of COVID. And so we have to look at these two things, immediate relief and long-term structural change, together. Otherwise, we'll always be finding ourselves back in crisis again and again.
I've only got 2 minutes, Xochitl, and I wanted to ask you about bail reform. Obviously, yeah. There's a progressive agenda here. The idea was that people shouldn't rot in jail because they didn't have money, as opposed to people who would get out because they did.
Yeah.
Now there does seem to be a modification of that in the budget bill. What do you make of it?
This is another example of, you know, the budget was not for this. The budget should have been lean and should have responded to the needs that we had and should have increased the revenue that we had. To be putting more people, more vulnerable people, into hotbeds of disease in our jails, that we're hearing even from the corrections officers, that we should be thinking about decarcerating, not adding more people into the jail system, this was a real failure of moral leadership. We will see the effects of this. We have seen disease continue to breed in places like Rikers. And we made great progress last year with these criminal justice reforms to shift back to a worse place, especially in this moment, and sending people literally to deeply unsafe, potentially deadly situations. There was no reason for us to head there. And it is a real moral failure that is that is really devastating to many of us.
Well, Xochitl, but the governor, and I only have a minute on this, and I don't even have that, but the governor seems to have wanted this thing to be changed so that it was, more difficult to, how shall we say, get through this. I mean, are you particularly chastising the governor?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the governor has pushed this through despite the both chambers, I mean, especially the assembly, being clear there was no space for it, despite advocates and people from a broad coalition pushing against it, despite even, the police union corrections officers speaking against it. There was no rationale for it. It is honestly a cruel policy at this moment. We're going to see the effects of it. We have to talk seriously about decarceration in our state more broadly, and especially in the moment of pandemic. To rely on increasing incarceration is a policy that we cannot support in any way.
Okay, I am so sorry. I had so many more things to ask you about marijuana and everything else, but you'll come back again, I'm sure. And so thank you so much for being with us. We've been talking with Xochitl Nemeca, the state director of the Working Families Party of New York, and we're so glad you were able to be with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Please be well. Take care, Alan.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.